Good morning. Welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Thursday, January 4th, 2024. We are now in the first week of what is going to shape up to be an amazing year. Thank you so much for tuning in. And yes, indeed, this is the Eastman Financial Report, and I am Dan Eastman. This is the first time in the history of this show that I'm wearing a necktie, but our founder of the WVW-TV, Brandon House, has been he's made the top 20 list for best dressed people. And I thought, you know, he's a sharp looking guy and I'm going to step up my game as well. So I put on my necktie, which I haven't worn teaching since back in the 1990s. But it is a very nice tie. It's silk and it's made in the United States of America. So I am now happy to be stepping up my game and bringing a little more professionalism to what is turning out to be a very, very interesting experience. And hopefully you're finding great value in my lectures that allow you to think about critical thinking when it comes to economic and financial reports. Thank you for tuning into WVW-TV. Congratulations to Brandon. It's a big deal. And we, as you know, WVW-TV has been broadcasting since about 2006, and we bring to the marketplace of ideas some very good content. When you think about how a free society operates, and of course our First Amendment under our United States Constitution, we're guaranteed freedom of speech. And of course, the idea is that we all have viewpoints and opinions, and bringing those viewpoints and opinions together into the marketplace of ideas is important, and that's how society grows and continues to change and get for the better. So we're happy to be able to exercise our First Amendment rights here on WVW-TV, and we do thank all of you for your viewership as well as your contributions to the WVW-TV Foundation. As you know, this is an expensive proposition to bring quality content 24/7. You can watch live, and then of course, if you're like me, you can't sleep at 2 a.m. You can watch reruns, but it's all out on our website and it's all available 24/7. So, that doesn't come without cost. And we really appreciate your continued support and sponsorship to help us keep this content flowing and current and consistent. We'd like to thank all of our sponsors. Of course, my sponsor last year was Swiss America Trading, which is a company based out of, it's an American company based in Arizona, and they sell precious metals. And if you're thinking about adding to your portfolio, you might want to give them, reach out to them at 800-519-6271, or go to their website at SwissAmerica.com and use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, and they will. You can shop around and see what they have to offer. They had a great special going last year, and I was talking about that. If you were looking for last-minute gifts, the gifts of precious metal is always valuable year-round. But certainly take a look and see what they have to offer. And I noticed that gold prices did rather well last year. When you think about the idea of inflation in our economy from 2022 and then 2023. In 2022, it was 9%, which is rather robust. In 2023, it was somewhere between 3.5 and 4, depending which number you look at. But at the end of the day, inflation is a thing. And if you look at tangible assets, they will tend to go up with inflation. The rising tide of inflation floats all boats, and certainly the great ship of gold and silver floated along with real estate and other tangibles. So if you're looking at 2024 to think about how are you going to position yourself in the event of a burst of inflation, certainly precious metals might fit the bill. So if you're thinking about that, give them a call or go online, and they'll be happy to send you free information, and you can take a look and see if that's right for you. And of course, you can give them a call, 1-800-519-6271, or go to the website, SwissAmerica.com, and you can shop around. And if you find something you like, you use the promo code Eastman, they'll know you heard about it on my show. But secondly, they'll know that, you're interested in free information and whatever specials are going to be running this year. So anyway, keep them in mind. And we do thank Swiss America for their continuing sponsorship of this network. Sponsors like them and you as viewers and other companies are really what keeps the information flowing. We're not a commercial network. We don't sell advertising. We're not beholden to advertisers. We are beholden to free speech, and we are beholden to critical thinking, and we are beholden to getting this message to the public so that the public hears more than just the canned mainstream commercially driven media. So it's a real opportunity. And of course, if you're feeling generous throughout 2024, you don't have to wait until next holiday season to write that check. You can go to the web at wvwfoundation.com and you can certainly continue to help support our network, because this is, again, it's not a cheap proposition. We function in a free market. We're thankful for a free market, not only of ideas and free speech and information, but also free market with respect to economics. And that, of course, takes money to do this sort of thing. So reach out to Swiss America, or reach out to the foundation. We're happy to have you do that. Okay, let's talk about the news. And I do have some interesting news. I had a few things yesterday that I wanted to catch up on. But one of the big stories, of course, this is Unemployment Thursday. Doesn't matter which month of the year it is. Every Thursday, the government comes out with initial claims for unemployment and continuing claims. And of course, this Thursday, today, they're reporting on last week. And of course, if you remember last week, that was the week between Christmas and New Year's. And of course, people tend to be taking a break, a mental break. There's simply not a lot of people that are going down to the unemployment office during the second half of December. And if they are, you keep them in your prayers, because those are people who are really, really in need. And the jobless claims dropped to 220,000 last week. Now, that's 220,000 who needed basically government support to pay the bills. And, you know, that's not a fun thing to be doing during the Christmas, New Year's, Hanukkah holiday. I mean, you know, the holiday season is a time that we're supposed to be joyful and relaxing and celebrating a good year. And here you got 220,000 Americans hitting the unemployment line, which is not good. So we keep them in our prayers. But the silver lining, I guess, it's never good news, but the silver lining would be that, you know, back in 2008, those numbers were 480,000 Americans. Now we're looking at 220. So that's the silver lining, and it's only half. The continuing claims, of course, is the second number we look at every Thursday, and that has dropped to 1.855 million people, which is continuing to decline. So what that tells you is fewer people are applying for unemployment and fewer people are remaining on unemployment. Now, it could be that the unemployment is a finite time. And once you've reached the end of those weeks, you fall off. You fall off the back end. You're still unemployed, but the money runs out. You fall off. You're only entitled. And it's different in different states because it's a state program. But at the end of the day, we don't know if people are finding jobs and leaving the unemployment roll, or if they're just basically using up, in Wisconsin, it's 2 years, you fall off the other end. And then that's a sad situation, because, you know, at some point, even that little bit of money runs out. But the theory, the state theory, is you want to get people looking for a job and get them back into the workforce. And, you know, you don't want people customizing their lives to live on a very small amount of money in a perpetual state of unemployment. So the idea is we'll help you until you find a job, and then, you know, you're back in the workforce. Unless you win the lottery, or perhaps if you're disabled or physically challenged, then there's other programs that will step in. So anyway, that's, I guess, good news that the unemployment claims are down, and you'd like to see that number being zero in a robust economy, especially when you think about our immigration situation. And, you know, as somebody who is the grandchild in my elderness of immigrants themselves, I tend to look at this story perhaps from a different perspective, or at least from my perspective. When you think about, there are times in American history when millions of people showed up in the United States seeking opportunity and seeking what they perceived in the old country, we used to say the old country, as being the shining city on a hill. And that's what a lot of people around the world look at the United States. I mean, this, the ability to shop at a Walmart or a discount merchant, sometimes we take that for granted in the United States. There are people around the world who think that would be just a utopia, to be able to go to a grocery store, or to be able to go to a big box retailer, or to be able to buy a car, or to be able to live in housing that is heated with indoor plumbing. I mean, this is a thing, and it's been very attractive, you know, for centuries to come to the United States to find a better life. And so when we hear this 10 million people sneaking in, it's problematic, because I think back to the good old days of the early 1900s. You know, this is an interesting story, because the mayor of New York is just apoplectic. You say, you know, New York has got a crater because all these people are piling in. Well, when I think about my ancestors coming in through Ellis Island, like I'm sure many people watching this program and across America, that was the port of entry, the main port of entry for people all over the world to come through Ellis Island to be processed. So the government knew who you were. They checked for diseases. And if you were healthy and you weren't a criminal, they let you in under some program or another back in the early 1900s. And you were in. And then, you know, you worked your way to becoming a citizen and America grew. And the city of New York has always been the epicenter. I mean, Ellis Island is in, you know, it's just off the coast of the city of New York by about, you know, I don't know, 1,000 feet. And it was a processing center where they processed millions and millions and millions of people. But instead of, you know, sneaking in across the border and breaking the law, people would come to Ellis Island, you'd apply, they'd process you through. And it was intimidating because if they found out you had tuberculosis or some disease, literally would put you back on the next boat heading back to Europe and you're out of here. You know, they were, and this is back in the early 1900s before like science happened, you know, medical science was pretty primitive in those days. But at the end of the day, this has been a country of immigration. And while I don't in any way condone this idea of just sneaking in, barging through and announcing you're here, I mean, you really ought to be going through a process and vetting people and figuring out why we have, you know, what are your intentions? Where are you going? In later times in the 1900s, you'd have to have a sponsor. And after World War II, especially up here in Wisconsin, this was a thing because there were so many people, German people that were living east of Germany that were homeless and displaced and effectively racing back to Germany only to find Germany in tatters. They continued on to the United States for resettlement. And you had to have a sponsor. It had to be somebody here that would sponsor you. And that was basically a guarantee to the government that that person's not going to hit the welfare rolls. You know, you're going to come here, find them a job, get them settled in. And that was that system that worked. And that's part of that processing of immigration. So from the perspective of these people just barging in and they're shipping them around in, you know, buses and airplanes and this and that, it just shows another failure of the United States. The federal government simply cannot function as well as it functioned 100 years ago. And if you could process people in 1903, you know, back in the day, basically before electricity, and get people settled and moved in and processed and recorded, everybody's name is in the book. I mean, people do genealogy these days and they look for their ancestors at Ellis Island. None of that's happening. And it's an amazing thing because in America today, when you think about it, how we are digitally tracked. I mean, if you've got a cell phone, and of course these people are getting free cell phones, which is crazy, but you are tracked from every moment of your life, where you are. Trust me, they know where you are as long as your cell phone is with you, but somehow they just simply can't seem to find the paperwork necessary. And this is just all political nonsense. But at the end of the day, what is going to happen is when you look at a country of $34 trillion in deficit, which we're broke. We're basically broke. Yeah, 330 million Americans that owe $34 trillion. You know, do the math. It just doesn't work. So what do? You got to boost up your population to spread that cost over a larger population. And of course, because the birth rate in the United States is lower than it statistically might prefer. At the end of the day, we're in a really interesting period of time, and that's why I'm not so convinced that we're going to see 10 million new Democrat voters showing up. I think this is what America does, and this is how America works. And while I think that this should be, in a rational administration, you'd have a processing centers all over the southern border or open up Ellis Island, and you'd find talented people to come in and make America a better place versus this chaos. And I think that this is going to be a big issue, obviously in 2024. But at the end of the day, you know, when you look at it from an economic perspective, we'll see how this plays out. And I'm that's why I'm cautiously optimistic. And as somebody who's the grandson of people who came in through Ellis Island legally, and they stayed here and became Americans, and my parents were Americans, and I'm certainly an American. At the end of the day, we'll see how this plays. But when you look at it from the deficit perspective, you'd have to double the population of the United States to bring $34 trillion into perspective. And that means everybody's paying half their income for three generations. We are in big trouble with respect to this deficit. And they're not addressing it. And we'll see what happens. They're going to promise the world in 2024. But at the end of the day, I believe when you look at the data from an economic perspective, from a financial perspective, I suspect that we are in a vortex situation where this debt can only be resolved two ways: default, which is not going to happen politically, or inflation, which is how every, from the Roman Empire forward, inflation is what happens, and that brings massive social change. And that's why when you start to look at the numbers, because people aren't stupid, okay, they're basically not. Most Americans are pretty astute when it comes to self-preservation and survival. And that's what I want to talk next. How am I doing time-wise? Okay, I want to talk next about the phenomenon we're seeing in the American housing market. And it's reflecting common sense, and people are moving themselves toward protection. Now, if you think about yourself as, you know, an average American person, a normal person, you're not Bill Gates and you're not sleeping on a park bench, you're in the middle, you know, my famous three silos. You got the middle class, which is shrinking, you got, you know, the lower income folk, and then you got the super silo of billionaires who they've escaped economic rules. So if you're a billionaire, economic rules don't apply to you. Put $1 billion on deposit in your local savings alone, and you're making $50 million a year interest at 5%. So if you're a billionaire and you're making $50 million a year in interest, okay, never mind your business income, you have escaped the velocity, the gravitational pull of the economy. You are floating around in an environment that is transitional. And that's why I think the billionaire class is becoming the aristocratic class, who basically are, you know, they think they're controlling the world. Yeah, 6 billion people plus or minus on the planet. And you got a bunch of people who simply don't have to worry about economics. Economics doesn't matter when you're in that zone. So if you've got, that's 1 billion, you know, this is some poor billionaire, some poor schlep down on the bottom of the list. Think about the guy with $200 billion. You know, at some point, money doesn't matter. I mean, you can't spend that kind of dough. That it just becomes power, and you can buy whatever you want. And unfortunately, when you look at how you know, democracies operate, you know, in a Republican form of government where you have representatives, and all you need to do is start pulling out the list of contributions, you see pretty much how the sausage is made. And that's unfortunate. But for the rest of us, okay, for the rest of us sitting here in the other two silos, at the end of the day, what you're seeing in the housing market is clearly reflective of rational human behavior. You know, in economics, we start with the assumption that people will act rationally, which means if a price goes up, they will buy less of it and they will start looking for substitutes. And that's rational. If the prices go down, more people who demand that good will buy it. That's rational thinking. And what we're seeing in the housing markets today, and there was an interesting statistic published, I wanted to do a little more digging into it. But the story headline is the average U.S. American household, when you look at the average income of American households, the effectively the bottom 15% can only afford to buy a house. Only 15% of households have enough income to afford the median price of a home in the United States. And this is a stunning thing, because what it's telling you is only 15% of our population has the capacity or wherewithal to buy the average priced home. I can probably buy a lower priced home or a fixer upper or something like that. But at the end of the day, what it tells you, if you take the median price of housing in America, only 15% of the population can buy that. Now, if you think about that from a classic supply and demand, Adam Smithian model, supply curve and demand curve, what that tells you is that the demand for housing is falling off because of affordability. Housing prices are too high so that only 15% of Americans can buy a house at the average price. And effectively what that tells you is that the price of housing in a rational market should drop. It should collapse down so that, you know, 50% of the people can buy the average price house. And it's not. And what it tells you is people who have a house are looking at that house as effectively a hedge against inflation. Now, how do you protect yourself against inflation? Well, you buy tangible assets. You can perhaps buy a bar of gold or a gold coin or a silver coin. But what America does is they're buying homes, because your asset is something you can live in. There's a roof over your head, keeps the rain out. But at the end of the day, this is how a rational market works. And what it's telling me is when you look at this data, that Americans are, in fact, hedging against inflation. And they're doing that through purchasing a home. And unfortunately, because of the supply is so limited and the demand, whether it being great, but if you simply can't qualify because you're not within that 15% band rate, then the people who have homes, and the people who don't. And this becomes very California-esque. You know, in the middle of the country, just about anybody around here wants to buy a house, theoretically can buy a house. If you've got any kind of stability in your income and, you know, you scrape a little down payment. But when you look at a market like California, it becomes very difficult for most people to buy homes. So you end up with a bifurcated world where the vast majority don't have an inflation hedge. And this minority have an inflation hedge, which is their home. And at the end of the day, as inflation pressures build and they're being pushed very much by this $34 trillion in debt, as that inflation pressure builds, you're going to have a greater and greater and greater divide where the masses don't have a lot and they have no protection from inflation. And, you know, the elite basically have inflation protection through their homes. And this is becoming something that is very unusual in American culture, because the whole idea, the American dream, as has been peddled for years, is that you'd come here, you get a job, you buy a house. And, you know, as inflation rises, you know, your boat is floating right along next to your neighbor's house and everybody's kind of going up in value. And we're seeing this starting to come unhinged. So we saw this unhinged to some extent in the 1970s into the 1980s. But then, you know, the market stabilized and interest rates were dramatically cut. And at the same time as people were buying homes, we didn't have that big of a growth in our population. And even 10 million isn't going to move the needle. It's not big enough to move the needle. It's not even 10%. And plus, you know, people are coming in, like most immigrants, don't have a lot of money. And they're you know, it's going to take a while to get themselves into a housing situation. So the point is, when we look at how does the average American protect themselves from inflation, the answer is it's basically in their homes and then perhaps some other tangibles. And, you know, if you're a worker with a 401k plan and you're putting money into it, you know, of course, that's managed money. And it's kind of amazing. You know, the stock market keeps going up and these 401ks are showing, you know, 5% loss. And you think, wow, that's kind of an interesting problem. Because if you wanted to basically shelter yourself from inflation, one of the thoughts is that the equities market, the stock market, where you buy stock in companies that own assets that will go up with inflation, that there may be some inflationary hedge there, but you'd have to talk to a financial advisor to sort through that. So I don't know. I thought it was an interesting story. It is an interesting story. And it just goes to show you that if you own a home, that's a good place to be. If you don't, it's getting to be a real scary place as inflation continues to push rents up. So, okay, I want to talk about a few other things. One thing that I'm following, it's an interesting story, is that I've talked about container shipping in the past. And as we live in a global economy, we know that the places like the United States have outsourced massive amounts of manufacturing to China and Asia and South America and places where labor costs are lower. And of course, the United States is very high labor costs. Unions that have, you know, driven this wages because they want a sustainable living wage, and I don't blame them. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, if you're going to deal with, you know, like we talked about the U.S. steel story, where being purchased by, you know, Japan. I'm not sure where that deal is right now, but the idea is if you're a manufacturer in the U.S. and you got to pay $35 an hour or whatever, and you can do this for $3 an hour in China, then you make it in China and you have to ship it back to the United States and you can sell it and your gross margins will increase and you'll make more money. But at the end of the day, this shipping container business is a global business. And it's not just the US, and you know, stuff is imported into Europe and, you know, it's exported from the US and Europe and imported into, and global shipping is a very big deal. We talked about this. We talked about how fuel costs impact dramatically the cost of shipping things from China to California ports. And then you put them on a train, you ship them around the country and distribute them. Well, the container business is big. And we've followed the story over the course of this last year that shipping container prices have declined rather dramatically because the economies are slowing down. There's less demand for goods. There's less stuff being shipped in. So what used to cost you $20,000 per container is now costing you $3,000. And prices have basically collapsed. Well, all of that changed when we entered into this period with the Israeli situation with the Gaza Strip. There's a big war going on, and of course, the one of the main shipping routes, of course, is the Suez Canal, which connects the Mediterranean Sea with the Red Sea and then out into the Indian Ocean. And then, of course, you can get over to China and other places. And a lot of the stuff that's imported into Europe comes around the Indian subcontinent and up through the Red Sea, through the Suez Canal, into the Mediterranean, where it's distributed into the European markets. Well, as a result of that conflict in the Middle East, of course, certain factions are shooting at and shooting at these container ships, and have effectively closed the Red Sea, because the Red Sea, you know, squeezes between Iran and Yemen along the Saudi Peninsula. And it's a very hostile place at the moment. So the point is that the Suez Canal business has sort of dried up. I mean, I suppose you could come from the Mediterranean down through into the Red Sea and take the risk of not having your boat blown up. But a lot of commerce has stopped. And of course, this is done strategically, because what they're trying to do is put pressure on Israel to, you know, calm things down and make everything, you know, quiet. But what's happened is it has really rerouted the container ship transport business, because instead of going through the Red Sea up through the Suez Canal, now you got to go around, you know, like in the olden days, the Horn of Africa, you know, and up back up. It's changed dramatically. So the cost of shipping things has gone through the roof. And not to mention, you also have the problem of, you know, the boats at risk. And of course, the U.S. Navy is supposed to be protecting these things. But at the end of the day, a container ship is kind of a sitting duck in the middle of the pond. And those things, you know, it's much easier to reroute, but rerouting costs money. So that's going to put additional strains on the supply chain, not necessarily with, you know, from China to the U.S., but as ships are seeking other routes, it, you know, it costs more money. It's adding a lot of cost, a lot of risk, and a lot of insurance risk to shipping containers. So again, that's an inflationary pressure that we're going to see and watch. And it's also a disruption of supply chain. Prices are up and you can't get the supply you had because of the supply chain disruptions. And that's the whole purpose of this politically, is, you know, you make it very difficult for ships to deliver things, and then you catch the attention of the belligerents, and then hopefully you come to a solution. So we're watching that. I think that's going to be a really interesting story. And the rates for containers right now are up 173%. You know, 6 months ago, I'm talking about how rates are collapsing, and if you want to ship something, it's cheap. Well, you know, that's almost a 200% bump because of this conflict. And it's having the effect that unfortunately it was intended to be. At the same time, there's another story out about the United States is now the top exporter of liquefied natural gas, which means we take natural gas here and we cool it down and we make it into a liquid and we put it into a boat and we ship it over to Europe and to some extent South America. But at the end of the day, it is an interesting phenomenon that we have costs that we deal with here in the United States to heat our homes and, you know, process heat and businesses. And at the same time, we have so much gas that we're able to export it and become the world's largest exporter of natural gas. I think we'll look a little bit more into that story as we go along this week. Well, I'm out of time for today. I hope you enjoyed the Eastman Financial Report. We're still trying to tweak our studio a little bit. This is the new look, and it's an American-made tie, so I think we're going to stick with this. And thank you so much for watching. Please consider WVW TV and your generous donations, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a great afternoon. Bye.